From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, tonight with Ry Cooder and his new album, Chavez Ravine.
Tell you about a friend of mine that you don't know. He lives way up a road that's lost in time. Don't know his name or where he's coming from. Only thing you know, he's a real gone cat, this friend of mine. He don't have no uptown friends that drive a Cadillac, but he's got cool threads and a beat up car. All his downtown friends like me ride around in the back, 'cause he's a real cool cat. Yeah, he's a real gone cat, this friend of mine. You want him to. Need a friend 'cause you're feeling blue. That old Faraday girl's never let you down. Na 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 na, living in a poor man's Shangri-La. Na 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 na, living in a poor man's Shangri-La.
In the 1950s, Los Angeles, Chavez Ravine, home to 300 Mexican families, a poor man's Shangri-La in the vision of our guest tonight, was leveled for a low-income housing project. The housing never came. Charges of creeping socialism did. Then came Dodgers Stadium in Chavez Ravine, and a dream was gone. For the last 3 years, L.A. native, composer, and virtuoso guitarist Ry Cooder has dedicated his artistic energy and his bank account to telling the story of the disappearance of the Ravine's community. To help, he called on some of the biggest names in the Chicano music scene, on the father of Chicano music, Lalo Guerrero, and Pachuco Boogie King Don Tosti, for what would be their last recordings, on William Garcia, Little Willie G of the Midnighters, on David Hidalgo from Los Lobos, and Erci Arvizu of the Sisters and El Chicano. The result? An intimate reimagination of a Mexican-American community bulldozed under, but alive in memory and music. Tonight on Point, Ry Cooder's tribute to L.A.'s Chavez Ravine.
The cool jerk and the alligator that I heard about.
Ry Cooder grew up in Santa Monica. He's a renowned session musician, solo artist, and movie soundtrack composer. His 1997 album, Buena Vista Social Club, revived global interest in vintage Cuban music and was an international hit. His new album is Chavez Ravine. He joins us from Los Angeles. Ry Cooder, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Great to have you. And, wow, you've done a lot of personal albums. This one has been described as the most personal yet. The LA Times says, this is Ry Cooder sorrowing for the vanished soul of Los Angeles. What are you up to here?
Being sorrowful for the lost soul of Los Angeles. No, I spend a good part of every day being sorrowful for the lost soul of Los Angeles. You know, you can't help it. You grow up here, you know. I used to like it better than I do now. Willie G's supposed to join us. He can't make it on time because he's stuck on the freeway because there's too many cars, because there's too many freeways. And I'm sorry he had to go through that, but we all just drive and drive and sit in cars, and I can't help but remember another time here. But it's not just a memory. It's the desire to create something with people collectively, which we did here, and just do something about music, which is from Southern California, I guess you could say.
Tell us the story of what brought your attention here. I mean, you have... Your eyes wandered, your ears wandered over all kinds of music, and of course, famously to Havana a few years back in the album and the movie that came out of that. Now, back to your own city and to this particular corner of it. What got your heart and mind and musical ear into this ravine?
Well, in Cuba, you know, the past and the present are one thing. They're joined. They're just, it's a weave. And I know everybody can understand this. You take one look at that film and you see... It's all living and it's all present, and nobody, you don't have to go jumpstart the past exactly or recreate it, because it's all around you, and that includes the music, which is the expression of the culture and the people. And they have their culture with them all the time, and part of what they have down there is their musical life and their musical heritage with them all the time. In Los Angeles, it's quite the opposite. I mean, I grew up in L.A. in the 50s hearing things on the radio that you don't hear anymore, such as Western Swing that was being recorded by people like Merle Travis and Speedy West in Hollywood, or South Central L.A. guys out of Dolphins of Hollywood down on 7th and Central, wherever they were. And this kind of stuff, too, this pachuco music, which Lalo did and Tosti did, they were practically the only guys that did do it. A hybrid, always these hybrid forms, people coming to L.A. and generally tending to leave their traditions quite in the dust, quite behind them. Because when you get to L.A., it's a city of immigrants, you know, you start doing the L.A. thing. So I think the L.A. thing is where you speed up the tempos and you hit the drums a little harder, and it all becomes a little more imaginary because there is no tradition here. So it's all made up in the minds of folks, kind of what we tried to do with this record. It's not like this existed. We had to dream up these tunes and dream up the settings and the characterizations, you see. It's not folk music in that sense. It's really just it's minds getting together and using music to tell stories, but I don't see this being done. It's not like we just jumped on the bandwagon.
You're really setting this in opposition to the kind of imaginations you hear working in Los Angeles so much today. You're trying to root this one deep and old and more broadly than what comes out of L.A.
Yeah, it's what we do, too. Willie and me, for instance, and we wrote a bunch of these songs together, and you might say that's what we do, that's what we're like. So another gang of folks would have done it differently. You'd have had a different record or something. But what I like about music is when folks actually do it, and they sit down together and they do it, and then you get something that people do rather than corporations cater in or phone in or that sort of thing. In other words, that's what music for me is anyway. That's how I grew up thinking what it was. It was just something people did because they liked to do it.
We put a quick gloss on it, but I wish you'd give us the story of Chavez Ravine, I mean, the historical story. You had a Mexican community near the center of L.A. on a hilltop, and what happened?
Well, in the post-war time in Los Angeles, there was a great need for housing. Many of the city's neighborhoods had really grown quite old. And under the Roosevelt administration of the 30s, the New Deal and so forth, there was a mandate and even a law that said when you find these so-called blighted neighborhoods or slum neighborhoods that have gone down too far down and they're unhealthy or they're this or they're that, then they should be rebuilt and they should be restructured, you know. And the federal government and the city governments together would work to make these places a better place to live. We now call this kind of thing affordable housing, which is kind of a vague and ambiguous term. But really, under the Roosevelt mandate, it wasn't affordable. It was to be done and given to the back to the people, which is quite a radical idea, and one that the Republicans and the Nuevo Fascismo right-wingers of the post-war time didn't care very much for. Didn't care for it at all. Especially the real estate developers who have always had the upper hand in Southern California. This was a great expanse of land, undeveloped, which people grabbed and began to develop. So they certainly didn't like the idea that the government was going to build housing for poor people. It seemed outrageous to them. So the easiest thing they could do in their overall broad-based attempt to dismantle the New Deal and all of those social programs, almost a job that's now practically complete, we can see, on its way to becoming complete. Well, the first and most vulnerable thing was public housing, which was easy to dismantle or to shake it loose, but simply by saying it was communist-inspired and creeping socialism, etc.
And that happened in this case, in the case of Chavez Ravine and Frank Wilkinson, the public housing advocate there.
Well, Frank Wilkinson was the guy caught in the middle. He was the spam in the sandwich, you see. He got he had the task of going and finding these neighborhoods, convincing the people, in the case of Chavez Ravine, who lived there, and Aliso Village was another such place, that they would be better off if they quit claim. You have to remember these people owned these properties. They weren't renters. So they had to give up the deed, give up their claim, and their, you might say, their property rights, which is a practically religious cornerstone of the founding of this nation. So we see how this new Supreme Court decision is a curious thing. And
this is the latest one allowing eminent domain for commercial reasons.
Yeah, eminent domain for commercial reasons, very key thing. So once these people agreed to do this, were given some money to leave and relocate, promised that they could come back in this utopian setting that would be constructed, then the right wing sort of faction in the city got started with the help of people like J. Edgar and others who were very eager to assist in any way that they could.
Hauled Frank Wilkinson before the House on American Activities Committee.
Yeah, they shoehorned him into a position where he was vulnerable because he was the one they knew they could use as the shoehorn for the whole operation, toppled the housing authority, or I should say the program, toppled the city government. In fact, the mayor, Fletcher Bowen, who was very much in favor of these projects, and got him out of there. And then the idea at the time would have been hand the land back or give these private developers, builders for private profit.
Real estate developers there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Give them free rein, let them run free, but it became politically, it was so heated up at that point and so volatile a situation, they felt they should do something different, so they kind of lured O'Malley and the Dodgers in there, and of course, you can see that it's a little strange to take what was at that point public land, had been taken back into the public domain and handed to a commercial enterprise, but professional sports, and particularly baseball, is so close to
seemed godliness. Like a public endeavor, and so the Dodgers Stadium ended up on top of this, what had been this community. They never got their housing. We've got to take a short break here, but going into it, Ry Cooter, I want to hear...
I get a breath here.
get your breath. I want to hear Don't Call Me Red. You wrote the lyrics on this when you're on the vocals. This is about the housing authorities, Frank Wilkinson, waging this losing battle for low-rent housing in Chavez Ravine. There's you went and talked with him, 90-some years old. You'll hear a little bit of his voice in here as well. Don't Call Me Red from Ry Cooter's Chavez Ravine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We had a dream that Los Angeles would become the first city in America free of slums.
That's enough to send you to San Quentin.
I was answering questions regarding rat infestation, and suddenly the questions were asking, what organizations, political or otherwise, have you belonged to since 1931? It was a totally improper question. I refused to answer.
Look, you've been through all this before. Just answer the question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Era la medianoche when oímos a scream.
We're talking tonight with Ry Cooter about his new album, Chavez Ravine. It's a kind of evocation of a Mexican community in the center of L.A. that was essentially paved over, wiped out in the 1950s to ultimately make way for Dodgers Stadium. Cooter looks back into history and finds a great richness in a sort of dreamed reimagination of that community, and he doesn't do it alone. On this album, he's joined by lots of top-tier artists from L.A., some real Chicano groundbreakers. Among them, and with us, along with Ry Cooter this evening, from Los Angeles, is William Garcia, better known as Little Willie G in the musical world, frontman of the 1960s legendary R&B group from East Los Angeles, the Midnighters. He's one of the leading innovators of the East L.A. sound. He's now an ordained minister. And behind us, you can hear him on Onda Callejera from Chavez Ravine. Willie G., thanks for joining us there in L.A.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Hello, Boston, and all points west.
I'm glad you made it through that L.A. traffic to sit down with Ry Cooter and with us. How did Ry reach out to get you involved in this? Did it make sense what he was up to when he invited you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm just grateful to David Hidalgo, who put me in touch with Ry. And when we met, Ry began to share his vision with me. And it actually sparked some memories. I grew up close to Chavez Ravine as a young boy. So it was a great meeting and a great vision.
You know, it might just set the tone for the background to Chavez Ravine if you'd tell us about the song that we hear behind us right now and the incident that it brings to mind.
Well, Ry is, in my opinion, the consummate student and teacher, and his research is just amazing on this project. And one of the areas that he discovered was the armory, which is now the police academy there in Elysian Park, requested 100 taxi cabs on a given night, and being post-war, and I guess pretty much just in the infancy of the Korean War, it wasn't unusual. We thought maybe they'd be shipping some guys back out to the islands or something, you know, but they loaded 3 to a cab, 100 taxi cabs, mind you, and took them right down to downtown Los Angeles and turned these young recruits loose on the Mexican-American youth.
These were U.S. sailors heading downtown where the Pachuco kind of hipsters were.
Well, it was Thursday night, I would imagine, which was Mexican-American night in downtown L.A. They could go to the restaurants, the movies, the clubs, the theaters. And so I think it was a really well-planned reconnaissance there. I don't believe it came from the Pentagon, this order. I never envision a full bird colonel, you know, sitting behind his desk, ordering these guys around. This was a street move, which onda callejera, loosely translated, means that, you know, some streetwise sergeant or some guy who had a little influence and authority over these young guys.
L.A. politics, street style.
Yeah.
And you had your so-called zoot suit riot there. Willie G, or do you prefer to be called Willie G or William Garcia at this point?
Brother Willie will work.
Brother Willie. That works that works both ways. The minister is in the house. Brother Willie, in that case, do you see the kind of political impulse of that sort of loosely organized rampage or beating as also at work in the bulldozing of the Mexican-American community at Chavez Ravine?
Sure. There's a lot of power behind what happened during this time. And working-class people trying to find their way into the mainstream, you know, we're given. I think Rye has another great song, Just Work. It's Just Work to me. And, you know, it gives a story of this guy who owns a bulldozer who got called in to come in and do a job, and that's what it was for him. And a lot of these guys, even the recruits, the sailors themselves, just guys following orders. It's a shame that they politicized or used the Mexican-American community as a focal point to lend credence to their scam, that there was this bad element that came out of Chavez Ravine, and they had to do something about it.
It was going to be cleaned up, but it would be for their own good. It would be for public housing. They'd be living in paradise. Right? It didn't work out that way. What did you learn about how the residents of Chavez Ravine thought about these changes when they were first approached? Were they trusting? Did they think that they were headed for the promised land here, not Dodger Stadium?
Well, you know, some did, I'm sure. Some signed and said, it sounds good. We'd like to do this. And the program was honest. The original housing, the concept, Richard Neutra, a famous architect, and others worked on it. I heard from his son that Richard Neutra would go down there to talk to people in the evening after work about things they'd like to see incorporated into new housing, such as this or that appliance or this or that architectural feature or whatever. He gathered information. You know, these people were trying to do something, and it was believed that it was the right thing to do. And at the same time, there are others living in there who were quite happy about things and didn't see any reason why they should be just told summarily that they had to get out. And I asked Frank Wilkinson when I was working on this record at a certain point. I said, Frank, now, looking back, you look at these photographs, some of these Don Normark photographs, said, what's really wrong with any of this? Tell me what it is that designates, you know, tell me what the yardstick or the criteria was.
With Chavez Ravine as it was, and you're speaking there of Don Normark's book, Chavez Ravine, 1949,
right.
And it shows very humble homes, but in what looks now like an idyllic setting, a kind of pastoral setting in the middle of L.A.
Yeah, which L.A. at one time really was like this. It was urban, it was rural, sort of mixed together, and incredibly beautiful, I happen to think. So he said, looking back now, that it was a terrible mistake. These houses were not as bad, he doesn't think it, in retrospect, as they were being made out to be. But you see, there was other forces here. Once you start telling it the rest of the city that this is a bad neighborhood, that crime is being bred up there, there's drugs up there, there's gangs up there, even bad American, un-American. This was, remember, in the time of the birth of the security state concept and the Americanism concept, and if you designate and present this negative image of people often enough in the media with the police department, our Chief Parker backing you up, you know, 100%, pretty soon the people are going to say, well, gosh, I don't want them living next door to me. Get them out of there. Do whatever you want. Because there were a lot of covenants and restrictions into where people could live, and they were being chased around, and we need this land for a freeway and this one for a skyscraper, and where were people going to live? And this is a kind of the way things went here. Frank Wilkinson told me it was toilets, toilets. outdoor toilets and rats in the trees. And yeah. I said, so exterminate the rats. You don't like the rats, so exterminate them already. What's the big deal?
Instead, they ended up with a stadium, and you've got a story here that's part political, part physical about that location, part economic, obviously, and then there's the cultural piece of this that helped you bring in Brother Willie G, with us tonight, and also some other real Chicano music greats. I want to hear a little bit of the music offered here by Lalo Guerrero and then Don Tosti. But, Rye, I wish you could tell us about them first. For our listeners who aren't familiar with these two men, both of them passed away since they recorded their offerings for this album. But tell us who they were and their importance. Lalo Guerrero first, if you could.
Well, Lalo's been recognized as the first Chicano, or that is to say, a Mexican descent born in the United States, if I think I've got that right, to record, to actually make records, 78s back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And he went on to have a career that just never stopped. I mean, he went on for decades and decades. And at one point in the 40s, you know, being influenced and having a liking for swing, black swing music and jazz styles, began to kind of seek out that sort of horn sound in some of those chord charts and with what we think of as pachuco lyrics, in other words, slang, in other words, a new topic. In other words, it wasn't just about cantina music or old love songs or ranchera music of the past, but you know, what are people in L.A. thinking? What are they writing? That's what he seemed to reflect, I think. And Don Tosti, moreover, was a jazz student. He studied with Charles Mingus. They had the same harmony teacher, which is amazing, really. And Tosti made very sophisticated swing records, I thought, and was a great figure. Both of them gone, the kind of thing you'll never hear again. You can't open the book anymore.
Right, stand by. I want to hear first. This is Lalo Guerrero. This cut is, pronounce it for me, Rye.
El Corrido de Boxeo.
El Corrido de Boxeo. And Brother Willie, this is the story of, can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a story of Carlos and Fabella Chavez, two young boxers from Chavez Ravine, who used to fight very frequently at the Olympic Auditorium here in Los Angeles.
And the song tells us that they believed that the way to fight was to fight clean. It was the only way to
win.
That's
right.
Let's listen to Lalo Guerrero.
Qué ironía, si lo sabes, que había dos hermanos Chavez, pugilistas que nacieron en mero Chávez Ravine. Carlos y Fabella Chávez, de la Loma y Palo Verde, decían, si peleas limpio, siempre ganas, nunca pierdes.
Lalo Guerrero was died in March at age 88, as I understand, Ryan Cooter, this was his last recording.
Yep, it's his last session, it's his last composed song, this song, and Tosti as well. I mean, you can search out their old records. They're pretty hard to find, but we're incredibly fortunate to have people like this who really live through it and give it all, as Willie says, life. I mean, when Lalo sings a song, you believe it. It's there for you.
Yeah.
It's right in front of you.
Now, Don Tosti, as you say, more jazz-influenced, 1948 hit Pachuco Boogie was called the first million-selling Latin song in America. That's a pretty big claim, a pretty big hit. You've got him singing in one of your kind of more surreal twists in the story here. You introduce, of course, it's the 50s we're talking about, and you've got a UFO with a kind of intergalactic hipster who flies in over Chavez Ravine. Tell us about this twist, Rye.
Well, I thought that it would be interesting to introduce a character with a different frame of reference. In other words, these people who lived there were blindsided by events and by power. The decisions of power in City Hall of about a mile away from Chavez Ravine, they didn't know what was coming. But suppose the UFO time traveler comes down, he knows what's coming because he has powers and he can see the future. So he warns these people, and this is a kind of a storytelling device, and then they can say, which was what I was interested in, oh, no, sir, you're wrong. We have rights. We're Americans. You just don't understand. It can't happen here. Mm. Which is one of my favorite things, because as soon as you say it can't happen here, the truth is already did, such as some of these situations we find ourselves in today.
And it happened to the people of Chavez Ravine, Don Tosti died last summer, age 81, in Palm Springs. But here he is, and is he speaking in the voice of your UFO traveler?
Yes, he's in the Kello slang of the day. It's very funny what he says. Some of the subtleties and the nuances of what he's saying a little over my head. But, you know, I went down and said, you can do this, Don. Just rap. Rap to us. tell us the way you see it. So he did.
I think Don really dug it. You know, in our culture, in the Hispanic culture, you know, we have all these legendary figures, you know, like La Llorona and El Cucuy. Mm. And this extraterrestrial cat, I don't view him as a scary figure, man. He's got on this metallic zoot suit, man, that's just sparkling. And he's got this cosmic guitar that looks like the front end of a Hudson pickup or something like that. And he's communicating to the people because he sees that these people are onto something. They're really living. And Chavez Ravine was like that. People carving out their lives just like everybody else, man. You know, a man's home is his castle. And as Rice says, he was prophetic. He came, and the people just couldn't believe it.
Let's listen to Don Tosti singing El UFO Cayo with the extraterrestrial hipster speaking to the folks of Chavez Ravine and Rykooters Chavez Ravine, the album.
Y súbanse al platillo volador, el UFO. Y de volada, vámonos a volar ese vato. Porque nuestro barrio ya se lo jambaron los gabachos. He dicho, no se agüite, cara de esquite. Ya estuvo, cara de tubo.
Ry, is that you on guitar?
Yes, my idea was that the guy plays a little trace to show the people that he can swing and can groove, and you know, just so that they'll listen to him. In the first song on the record, he comes down because he's lonesome. He's looking for Amati Legion Stadium and little Julian Herrera and the people of the neighborhood have to kind of like take him aside and say, you know, you're being a bit forward with our women, etc. But like Willie says, he's not. This isn't a mass media expression of terror and fear and paranoia. This is just a guy who, kind of like me, I think, you know, who just wants to get to know folks. Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't?
He flies in. He proves his chops with a guitar lick. He wins their confidence. But they don't believe him when he tells them what's going to happen to them. Well, Willie G., you've got a song on the album called Muy Fifi. It's a mother-daughter conversation, and I guess this is imagined as kind of just part of the life of Chavez Ravine as it's rolling along. Take us into it. What's it about?
Sure. Anyone that grew up with sisters in their home pretty much is familiar with this conversation. In our culture, the dad sort of takes the back seat. He's real quiet. He loves his daughter. Doesn't say much. But the mom, who has experience with men and what men are like, is trying to convey to the daughter that this guy that never comes to the door but always just pulls up in the car and wraps his pipes, you know, to let her know he's arrived, is just, you know, pretty unsavory, you know. You can still see his knife through his baggy zoot suit pants, you know. Right. And he looks the type that likes to go out looking for trouble. But Fifi is assuring mom that this guy is respected. No one ever harms her. He always gets her home safely. You know, she gets respect from the other kids when she's with Smiley. And it's just a typical story of young people who in their minds are invincible and immortal, and there's never a sense of danger in anything they do.
Rykooter, you found, you tracked down Ercy Arvizu to sing the vocals here. She was with the sisters in El Chicano. You found her in Arizona working as a FedEx driver.
Well, that's exactly right. They were, the Arvizus were a great family, are a great family in East L.A., and I had only seen them appear in a book of a sort of history book of East L.A. music, and this photograph of the three of them. And I said, well, these are the Miss Chavez Ravines. Where are they now? So we made a couple of phone calls.
And tracked them down. Here, Ercy Arvizu with Muy Fifi, lyrics by Willie G. from the album Chavez Ravine, Rykooter's new album. I'm Tom Ashbrook. A lot more we're going to hear tonight. We'll be right back.
Ay, mama, ¿por qué te apuras cuando estoy con Smiley? Me guardo sin duda. Si salimos del barrio, los demás nos respetan. Nunca estoy en peligro y los bookies me aceptan.
Aliéntate, loca, dile, dile, loca.
Siento su ranfla, estridosa, y se guacha, loca y bufarra. Pero confío que llegaré en un pedazo a la casa.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ry Cooder, virtuoso guitarist, composer, film score composer, and, of course, famous for his Buena Vista Social Club album of 1997 and many more great ones before that. He joins us tonight from Los Angeles. With him, Little Willie G, who was one of the great innovators of the East L.A. sound in L.A., of course, frontman for the 60s R&B group The Midnighters, a big contributor to Chavez Ravine. Ry Cooder, you're 58 now. What makes you angry these days, and what brings you joy these days?
Oh, well, getting up in the morning, you take and you always check the weather first, because that's my favorite thing, is what's the sun look like? You know, what are the plants? How are the birds doing? And where we live is pretty and green. Fortified in that way, I go down and I tackle the papers. Then after about 20 minutes of reading the newspaper, I'm mad. But I don't want to stay there, because that's very limiting and frustrating, you know, and frustration can be a deep thing, too. So the next thing I do is I say, now, let's leave that. Before it gets too problem-ridden, let me leave that here. I'm going to go into the yard or something and sit with my lyric book and try to figure out a song or an idea or a line or a rhyme or anything.
Yeah.
Now, if I can do that for a couple of hours, this is how I began every day of this process of making this record, let me just tell you.
Mm.
I had so much fun doing this. The more I did it, the more I could forget about the news and the papers and the problems. Then I began to think, I'll just keep doing this because I'm having the best time and I'm just going to keep messing with this idea. And it takes me away from problems, and I like to do it, but then I started to get tired, and then I started to think, there's a window of opportunity. This record should be presented. Now's the time.
Yeah. It sounds like it almost swallowed you up. You've said your wife was a little worried about how deep you were teetering into this realm of memory.
Well, this is kind of, she knows that this is what I sort of do this anyway. I mean, I tell you, this is what music is for me, always has been. It's kind of an escape mechanism. But we create things. I mean, out of music, you know, then come ideas are passed and go into the conduit or the conveyor belt or whatever it is. And the main thing that happens is we get together. So this is what I always observed about records. You could say, let's record. And everybody will focus their mind and get interested and enjoy it. And then you're with new friends and you're thinking of things and life is good. Mm-hmm. That's the joyful part. Believe me, nothing I like better than counting off, let's hit it.
Brother Willie, let me ask you, along those same lines, I mean, here you've got this wonderful evocation of another time, of a place that's now buried, and there's anger, but there's also joy in bringing it back. You've also got L.A. going on all around you right now. You've got a new Latino mayor, the first one in a century there, Antonio Villaraigosa. What about your sources of hope and despair these days? We started off the hour talking with Ry Cooder about the L.A. Times said that he's sorrowing for the vanished soul of the city. Where are you at this moment in terms of the way you think about L.A., its soul, its future, not just the past we hear in this album?
Well, I always approach things with a sense of hope. Much like Ry, our regiment's pretty similar. I guess in the morning you get up, you look around and see what's coming. And I tackle the scriptures first. And this morning I read Psalm 120, verse 1. It said, in my distress, I called upon the Lord, and he heard me. So I always approach things with a sense of hope. And it's wonderful. We do have a new mayor, and our prayers and support are with him. I really believe he can do a lot for the city. He's in touch with pretty much forgotten aspect of our population, and I think that's really cool. He's a graduate of Cathedral High School, and we have so much in common, speaking from a personal perspective. And I really believe he can do a lot. Getting back to the Chavez Ravine project, and at the moment there ain't no place else to go. I really love just the whole concept and energy of it, because to me it brings back, you know, Raya's reminding us of things we've always known. And it sounds to me what a community must have looked or sounded like even today. But the music is just so real. The stories are so real. These aren't fabrications, really. These are really, really stories, and they're about people that are living or have lived, and the legacy that they've left us.
Right. As I listened, I wondered why you didn't just go all the way and make this into a kind of stage musical. I mean, it seems to essentially be the score for a musical opera.
Well, I'll tell you what. I make records, and that's what I feel I do best. And if somebody has this idea, if they're listening, I know how to do that. They're sitting there thinking, then let me hear from them. It's another task, of course, you know. To demonstrate this is another plane of reality. In other words, we don't have to prove it. We just sing about it. The mind takes over. I'm an old-time fan of radio theater. That was my first favorite thing. Soap operas.
Yeah.
Helen Trent, Argyll Sunday. I just loved those things when I was a little kid so much. Mm. I still do. The idea of it is wonderful. Your mind makes your own pictures. You use your mind a bit.
Fills in all the blanks.
You meet it halfway. Mm-hmm. To have to prove this, I would worry about having to, I don't know, go into stereotypes and I just don't know how to do it. But you see, one thing nice about this, I'm starting to get interesting letters and people are communicating things, and I'm just betting that around the corner somebody's going to come and have an idea or two. Personally, I like cartoons. I'm hoping I can get some animation going here.
That might be the way. It might
Chinito,
be the way.
Chinito will make a great cartoon.
Oh, Chinito.
But we'll see what happens next.
Where the girls, Chicano girls, are kind of running along behind the Chinese laundromat singing the kind of taunting song through the streets there. There's another song I wanted to ask you about. In My Town, this is yours. You sing it, and it starts off sweet and gets very menacing. And I'm trying to figure out who this guy is, who's dreaming about being in his room, like his bedroom, looking out over the city. Who's singing In My Town?
This is a little confusing to people a bit, but you see, I believe that these developers, these real estate visionary, you know, mogul types, they weren't born billionaires, or they weren't born with a phone bank. You know, they built this idea. They're like any entrepreneur in Southern California. You know, it's like the entrepreneurs of junkyards, the entrepreneurs of dirt track racing. These guys kind of fall into these categories, you see. So I say, what I propose here is, here's a guy completely isolated from humans. Mm-hmm. He has no group, he has no family, he has no race. He's alone. And when he's alone, he's very quiet. He doesn't communicate or talk or have fun or go eat cheeseburgers with anybody. He sits in his room and he hears things. He hears sounds come to him because he's so quiet, because he's all in his mind. It's not a conversation. It's his brain talking to you. So he hears the trolley car. He hears the rain. He hears the clock. So you get this idea. It's a strange fellow, you know. He's all by himself. He's going to tell you what he sees. He looks down. He sees the chaos of races and the action of the street, and he doesn't like it. He says, I'm going to clean this up. I'm going to fix it. You're going to do what I say, and I'm going to flatten it out, which they did, and they're going to make it uniform, which these guys love. They love uniformity, and they love order. And this is the truth about these people. And these people, when I speak of them, I call them the satanic builders. Mm-hmm. And there are particular individuals over time in the history of L.A. who have had a very firm hand in shaping what Los Angeles is today. That is the, I hope Brother Willie will excuse, the satanic builders.
I believe it.
And it's still true to this day. Make no mistake. So I see this, and I present you with this character, and he, in this kind of Peter Lorre voice, I actually was thinking of Lawrence Ferlinghetti and his ability to recite poetry. I love very much how he is telling you these things, you know, and
well, let's listen. Here's Ry Cooder from Chavez Ravine with his track, In My Town.
And there's a freeway coming soon. Right through this dirty old room. Can't you see? A 50-story building where a palm tree used to be. Now I like a town that's flat. I like a street that's tame. You take out the trash, they all do the same. I get right back inside and remain until notified in my town. Now I want a town that's clean, and I want a rule that's maintained. If you're brown, back down. If you're black, get back. Better white than right, better dead than red. Better keep it contained in my town.
And on goes the mind of the developer, Raikouters Chavez Ravine there in the song In My Town. A freeway coming soon, and he couldn't be happier about it. A community lost, bulldozed in 1950, ended up being the home of Dodger Stadium. Right, that's Dodger Stadium today.
Yes, Dodger Stadium today, which is there's rumors that the new owner of the ball club, who as a result, of course, owns the property, wants to dismantle the stadium, which we now view as historic and an older stadium, after all, and build a fancy new corporate, with corporate skyboxes and stores and restaurants downtown next to Staples Center. And so if he does that, of course, this is going to become a big issue here in town, because everybody who loves the old stadium and likes to go and just have their day of baseball is not going to like that very much.
Where do you see Los Angeles going, Raikouter? I mean, it goes on and on. You've got the kind of nostalgia and wish for something more intimate and more grounded that you're expressing here, that Willie G is expressing here. But is it rounding a corner back toward that, or is it heading off toward a different future?
Well, I don't know. I mean, listen, nowadays we have, for instance, more and more of these big shopping centers. They used to call them shopping centers. That's their malls now, the big malls, huge malls. And they're starting to make these things with apartments upstairs. I mean, you know, and hospitals inside them. I mean, so pretty soon, and then they become theme park oriented. And so you find these little replicated faux neighborhoods in which you will experience a neighborhood, you know. Park here, take a look, the escalator to the 10th floor, and experience a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that's what I think happens in a place like this. But that's because it's for profit, and it is extreme globalization. And it all started in Los Angeles. You know, the shopping centers were invented here. A lot of things were invented here, and theme parks were invented here, after all. In Southern California, Disney and stuff. Mm. Don't get me started. So, of course, my age, I'm 58, and I remember the little chili joint down on the corner, and even in Santa Monica, which was nowhere near as deep in a neighborhood environment as, say, for instance, East L.A., Bunker Hill, Chavez Ravine, Aliso Flats, any of those places. So, believe me, I know. But still, we look upon this, and it's going to be where you just won't get from point A to point B. On the other hand, like Willie says, Villaraigosa's got a different consciousness. He may have a different agenda. Somebody with some sense and some feeling for where people live and how they live could make a real difference. Mm-hmm. Do we have to just give up our instinctive way of living just because somebody said so, you know, as one of these In My Town guys said so? Mm-hmm. But that's a question that people are also going to have to answer for themselves. And in the end, you know, if you don't exercise power or at least judgment and choice for things that you want or that you like, then you just give up. And before you know, it's a case of it can't happen here. And the next thing you know, you turn around, you just don't have it anymore.
Willie G, Brother Willie, you've got a Latino mayor now, and if not already, a Latino majority coming soon. Raikouter looks back to this Mexican-American community in Chavez Ravine as a kind of idol. What about a more Latino future? Does it look better to you? Does it look more grounded? Does L.A. look like Mexico City in 30 years? Or how do you see that future coming in that great big city by the sea?
I don't see it looking like Mexico City or anything like that, but I think if people would just take time to go down to Olvera Street, you know, and walk there, there's the coolest mall, you know, in Los Angeles right there in downtown. Or just take a ride over the bridge over to First and Indiana to the Mercado, and you'll really get a sense of what Los Angeles is really like. There is a cross group of ethnicity here, which is really cool. Yeah, the population, our population as Hispanics is growing by leaps and bounds. So, but I don't see it becoming like Mexico City. I just see Los Angeles becoming a place where if the people are given their voice, it will become everything that it was intended to be, a place where people could live, where they could gather, where they could exchange ideas and commerce and everything a city's supposed to be.
There's Brother Willie standing on the good book and sounding confident. Raikuta, we've just got half a minute left here. We want to go out with Third Base, Dodger Stadium. Tell us about this song.
Well, you know, so you're it's night and there's a night game and the families pull in and there's a guy pulls up in his Ford wagon, the kids pile out, and somebody says, "Hey, mister," you know. He turns around, doesn't see anybody, and hears this sort of disembodied voice from the darkness of the parking lot, and somebody starts telling him about how it used to be before the stadium. In other words, the neighborhood that is in fact buried under that stadium, because you have to remember it was a bowl shape and they filled it up with cement and dirt. And so the truth is, archaeologically, that underneath stadium there is a town down there. And when I learned that, of course, this hit me pretty hard. And I thought, man, how does that get into song form? Let's see if we can do this. And then this fellow Joe Kevany had heard that people say, "I'm from third base, I'm from home plate."
My house was by third, my house was by home.
Yeah, underneath it.
Yeah.
So he sent this idea, and Willie and I sat there and sort of crafted this tune. And it does say that there is something underneath, and that's very true in Los Angeles. There's a lot going on under the surface, but you kind of have to dig for it, you know. But it's a beautiful song.
You've got Bla Painui, the Hawaiian musician, on vocals here. We'll go out with it. Willie G, Brother Willie, William Garcia, thank you very much for joining us to take us into this wonderful slice of history. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Raikuta, you always surprise, this time practically amaze. It's a real journey, and I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for doing a good job.
It's great to do it with you. It's Third Base, Dodger Stadium, from Raikuta's Chavez Ravine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Yes, I'm a baseball man myself. Yes, I'm a baseball man too. Baseball can be very good to me. Yes, baseball can be very good to me.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.